You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
Okay. Good evening. Let's start with our motivation. So, Venerable Yeshe said something very, quite profound at, after the BBC at lunchtime today, that it's a lot happier having a virtuous mind. A lot more pleasant to have a virtuous mind. So rather than see a virtuous mind, a mind with good motivations and good intentions, as something that we just have to work so hard to generate because it's so difficult, you know, to think, you know, wow, when I train my mind to think that way, I'm going to be happier and everyone around me is going to be happier. And when you start to do that and you experience that joy and that relief of the burden when we have unwholesome mind states, when you start tasting the result of the practice, then you get more and more enthusiastic about practicing because you can see that it works. So yes, sometimes we have to wrestle with our mind a little bit to get it to let go of something that it's clinging to. But when we consider that this is the path to happiness, then that, you know, that will invigorate our practice. Yeah, so Dharma shouldn't be something that we have to do in order to be a good person. It's something we want to do because it brings delight here and now and creates the cause for more happiness in future lives and, of course, the ultimate happiness of full awakening. And so as we learn about the Bodhisattva's grounds this evening, then let's see that as a roadmap to experience one happiness after the other. And that our own happiness comes from bringing joy to other beings. So with that kind of intention, let's listen this evening. From the 57 faults. And then last week we talked about an overview of the paths and grounds, okay, and the different characteristics that differentiate the different paths. Okay, so there were four factors that differentiated the paths, what are they?
Set of 12 qualities that increase with each.
Okay, so the sets of 12 qualities that increase with each bhumi.
And there's the majesty and power where the afflictions from the grosser to the more subtle get eliminated in each one of those. necessary.
Yeah. Necessary. Okay, so more and more afflictions are eliminated on each one, more and more subtle afflictions. Then? Yeah, with the perfection, one of the 10 perfections that's brought to excellence. And?
Rebirth.
Yeah, the ripening rebirth that that being is able to take. And why is taking that ripening rebirth something important? Yeah, to benefit sentient beings. Because if you have worldly power, you can influence more and more living beings, and that helps. Yeah. Okay, so now we're going to start on the actual 10 bodhisattva grounds. Oh, we also talked about last time the meditative equipoise of the Aryas and the subsequent, subsequent attainment. So what's going, what are the different divisions of meditative equipoise?
The uninterrupted path.
Okay, and what's the uninterrupted path?
Afflictions are beginning to be eliminated and yeah,
are in the process of being eliminated. And that's followed by?
A liberated
path. And what is that?
They're abandoned
forever. They can no longer appear. And then the third one?
Which is neither one.
Yeah. And what is that?
Everything else.
And meditating on emptiness.
What?
You're meditating on emptiness, but you're not really yet abandoning anything further.
Yeah. So you're meditating on emptiness, but your meditation hasn't reached the stage of the next uninterrupted path where you start beginning to eliminate a new set of defilements. Okay. And then the subsequent attainment, what's going on then?
The method side of the path, seeing out of meditative equipoise, where you're looking at your meditations are more like illusion-like, to see how the world exists illusion-like. And doing your bodhicitta and cultivating your compassion and generating a lot of merit.
A lot of merit, doing primarily the first three of the perfections, and together with all of that, practicing the illusion-like meditation, where you're seeing things as like illusions. So what does it mean to see things like illusions? Does that mean they kind of appear, and then they disappear, and they appear again?
Keep remembering that how they appear is not how they actually exist.
Okay, how they appear is not how they actually exist. So how are they appearing, and how are they existing?
Appear inherently existent.
Okay, they appear inherently existent, and?
They're not.
Yeah, so does that mean they don't exist at all?
No, they exist.
They exist, how?
Dependently.
Okay. So the words sound great, don't it?
I know they do.
Yeah. Can you discern between what dependent existence looks like and what inherent existence looks like?
No.
You know? Can you separate those two?
No.
Difficult, isn't it? But at least, you know, that we have to start with getting the words and concepts, you know? And then at some point we'll get some more experience. And then at least we'll have the words and concepts to compare our experiences to. Yeah.
When you describe this, I guess I need the mic.
Yeah.
When you described this, you said that this wisdom of subsequent attainment has two types. Mm-hmm. Is the first one the wisdom engaging in the method side of the path? And the second one is the illusion-like meditation?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, you have to have some wisdom when you're practicing the method side of the path. You know, because there you're dealing with conventional things, so you need to be able to, you know, differentiate virtue and non-virtue and all those kinds of things. Okay. So, so before, way a long time ago when we studied the paths and grounds, we went through the here's paths and grounds, you know, with the eight stages, you know, to each of stream entry, once returner, non-returner, and arhat. And so here we're going through the grounds of the bodhisattvas. Yeah. We're starting here with the path of seeing, the third path, yeah, where they have the direct non-conceptual realization of emptiness. Yeah. By the way, what is ultimate bodhicitta?
Realizing emptiness in the mind of an Arya Bodhisattva.
Okay, it's the wisdom realizing emptiness in the mind of an Arya Bodhisattva. What is an ultimate ground?
Exhaustion. It's the same as ultimate bodhicitta, which is the unhindered wisdom of a bodhisattva realizing emptiness supported by bodhicitta and compassion.
Yeah, so it's that same, exaltant, you know, ultimate bodhicitta that's supported by the method aspect of the path, by conventional bodhicitta. Okay, so verse 441 and 442. So we're talking about the grounds now. So these are all ultimate grounds. So the first of these is called the joyous. Yeah, we talked about joy in our motivation. So it's called the joyous because the bodhisattvas experience great joy since the three fetters have been eliminated and they have been born into the Tathagata family. Through the maturation of that ground, the perfection of generosity becomes supreme. They are able to make 100 worlds quake, and they become the great lord of Jambavipa. Okay, so here, these are Nagarjuna's verses, but they're based on the Sutra of the Ten Grounds, which is found within the Avatamsaka, the Flow or Ornament Sutra, which is a huge, enormous sutra. Okay, so the first ground is called the joyous here. And it's said because that bodhisattva is free of three fetters that are to be abandoned on the path of seeing. So those three fetters are view of a personal identity, deluded doubt, and then view of rules and observances. Okay, so here the terminology may be a little bit different than you're used to, because remember, view of a personal identity is describing the meaning of the term, not so much the literal translation. Because view of the perishing aggregates doesn't tell you a whole lot. Okay, doubt, I think you get. Here when we say doubt, we're referring to afflictive doubt. You know, the doubt that's inclined towards the wrong conclusion. So it's not curiosity, it's not kind of maybe, it's like really you're on the way down the slippery slope. And then the last one, the view of rules and observances, sometimes this one has a bunch of different translations. Sometimes the view of ethical conduct and practices, I mean, it's had many different translations, okay? But, and they're, the way it's described in Pali tradition and Sanskrit tradition sounds different, but it essentially boils down to the same thing, okay? Which is that you have a wrong idea of precepts. Yeah, the first, in the term, it's sila. So sila means ethical conduct or precepts. So you have a wrong idea about that. You don't know what is virtuous and what is non-virtuous. So maybe you think that animal sacrifice is virtuous and killing the infidels is virtuous and this kind of thing, you know, which we see a lot of even today. Okay? And so that's the first part of it, the sila. And then the second part of it, sometimes it's called practices, sometimes observances. But what it means is, I guess practices, the things that you do to practice the path. And so in the Tibetan tradition, they give the examples of, I guess this happened in ancient India, where you jumped on a trident, and if the middle part came out the top of your head, it meant you attained awakening. So clearly not a good practice. In the Pali tradition, they give the example of just thinking that the way you do a practice is more important than transforming your mind. Yeah, and so people getting stuck on, and this comes from the Brahmanic tradition, where when you do a Brahmanic puja, something in the Vedas, it has to be done exactly according to the formula. Otherwise, you haven't created merit, you haven't pleased the gods, and so forth. So instead of valuing the mental transformation, thinking that the virtue is by keeping just the details exactly. Okay? So even though the examples the two traditions give are different for that second part of it, it basically comes to the same point, which is what you're practicing isn't leading to the result that you want. You have the wrong idea of what you need to practice. Okay? So again, in our world, there's lots and lots of that. What's interesting is in the Pali tradition, yeah, the way they describe it, these three, the Pali tradition doesn't talk about innate, they don't use the words acquired afflictions and innate afflictions. They don't use those words, but the meaning is there in the sense that view of a personal identity, deluded doubt or afflictive doubt, and view of rules and practices, those, they say, are eliminated completely when somebody becomes a stream enter. So here it's when you become a first ground bodhisattva. Yeah. But the stream enter and the first ground bodhisattva are similar in the sense that they have both first newly realized emptiness directly and non-conceptually. Okay. Now, where you have some differences is, you know, from the viewpoint of at least the Prasangika, the view of a personal identity is innate, so it's not completely eliminated on this path. Yeah, only the acquired form of it is eliminated. But doubt and view of rules and observances, they only have acquired forms. So they're eliminated. And, okay, so the ornament of clear realization says that on this, you know, the path of seeing, and here we're talking about a bodhisattva who's freshly practicing the bodhisattva path, not one who's gone through the hearer path, attained arhatship, and then has come back to do the bodhisattva path. So in the ornament it says that doubt, wrong views, holding wrong views as supreme, and rules, view of rules and observance, rules and practices, that all of those are abandoned on this path, that they all have only acquired forms. Yeah? But view of a personal identity and view of eternalism and nihilism, yeah, those two, according to at least the Madhyamakas, I think the ornament too, have innate forms. So they aren't, only their acquired forms are eliminated here. In addition, again, according to the Madhyamakas, the acquired forms of all the afflictions are eliminated at this point. So not just jhigta, not just a view of personal identity, doubt, and view of rules and observances. Okay. So, you know, these are eliminated, you know, process of being eliminated on the uninterrupted path of the first ground. They're fully eliminated at the liberated path of the first ground. And then when that bodhisattva arises from their meditation, that's when they experience great joy. Because they're able to reflect and realize, oh, I've eliminated that stuff. And they go, yippee! You know, because it feels so good to be free of the burden of those afflictions. Okay? Yeah. Okay, so we covered all that. Okay, then the verse also tells us, okay, so they become the joyous. Why do they become the joyous? Because they've eliminated, you know, all the acquired afflictions. And then, so that's what it means when it says the three fetters. What I find interesting is the three fetters is exactly what the stream enterer does. Okay? So that's really showing that here, anyway, there's a very, in the mind of Nagarjuna, there's a very close relationship between, you know, what the stream enterers are freed from and what the first crown bodhisattvas are freed from. And then I wonder, where does it start becoming that these bodhisattvas are free from all acquired afflictions? Yeah? Like, where in the development of the history of the Madhyamaka does that come in? Because here, you know, Nagarjuna is not saying they're free from all the acquired afflictions. So, you know, did they not use that term? Is that a term, at Nagarjuna's time, is that a term that they began to use later? Yeah, it's just interesting to me. Okay?
But then you're saying that somewhere along the line they have said that the bodhisattvas eliminate all of the
acquired afflictions
on the first ground.
On the first ground, yeah.
But here it seems like they're both pretty even on just partially.
Yeah, here he's only citing these three fetters. Mm-hmm. And he's calling them fetters, which is the term used in the Pali tradition.
Not acquired afflictions.
And not acquired affliction, which is the term that we usually use now. So I'm just wondering, in the historical development of the tradition, when did that term, you know, acquired afflictions come into being? Like I said, they have the distinction in the Pali tradition, but they don't have those precise terms. Yeah. So it's quite interesting, you know, when you kind of do some research about the evolution of terms. Yeah? Like what terms were actually found in the sutras and then what terms do you find afterwards? Yeah? Because I think, I can't remember exactly, so I'm not sure on this one, but I think I checked the Nagarjuna's Karikas and I did a search for the term true existence and that precise term wasn't there. Interesting, isn't it? Yeah? So just, I mean, to think about how the explanation developed, because I think maybe if you read Tibetan and you're studying, then you can see the different layers, because you have the sutra quotation, you have the shastra quotation, you have Jay Rinpoche's explanation, then you have your Yigcha's explanation. And you can see all those differently and maybe see how they build on each other. But when we tend to study, we tend to go for the meaning, the whole meaning of the whole thing. You know, tell me, okay, just, you know, tell me the whole meaning of the whole thing, not the development, you know? And, but I think as you go as you start to go on and on, then you start to maybe question, you know. And in the same way Jeffrey's showing us passages from the Sutra and from Jay Rinpoche and then from Jamyang Shepa and then from, what's his name? NP, Nawang Peldon. Okay, so, you know, and learning to see when you read a text how things develop and how they interpretate. Oh, excuse me, we don't use the word interpretation. How the fleshing out change, you know, manifests over time. Okay, so then also it says that they've been born into the Tathagata family. So it's quite interesting. We were working on a passage this morning from the Upadhyaya's commentary when you take the Shamanera ordination, and you often hear the term child of a good family, mm-hmm. or son or daughter of a good family, and Venerable Dhamcha was saying that her impression has always been in the Chinese tradition that it's referring to your biological family, you know. That's just been your impression. I don't think you've heard it in a teaching. But in any case, when they talk about the Buddhist family or the Tathagata's family, they're, you know, or good family for that matter, they're not talking about your biological family, okay? It means that you, by generating bodhicitta and following the bodhisattva path, you've become an heir to the Buddha. So they often use the term son or daughter, yeah, or child. Actually, what the meaning is, and we were discussing this at the Western Buddhist Teachers Conference this last time, and Steve Carlier, Venerable Steve, who's a translator, was there. So we were talking about how the actual meaning is, it's like the child is the heir to their parents. Whatever the parents did, you're going to grow up and be in the family business, kind of like that, you know? So here, who are your parents? They're the Buddhas. And, you know, you're the Buddha's heir. You're going to grow up and be a Buddha. So when you hear, you know, child of a good family, it's referring to a bodhisattva. You know, it's not referring to somebody who was born in a rich family or something like that, you know, or a nice family. It's referring to you have had a change of mind. The word that is translated as family, rik, here, is often translated as lineage, or caste, okay? So it's the whole idea is that you are an underling progressing to take on the role and responsibilities of the grown-up in your spiritual tradition, okay? So it said they're born into the Tathagata family or the Tathagata lineage. You know, and family and lineage, you can see, you know, lineage, yeah, one thing passed down to the other. In a family, you have your familial lineage too, don't you? Yeah, so here it's kind of like seeing the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas as a big family, yeah? So Steve was saying, oh yeah, maybe translating it as heirs of the Buddha, you know, because saying child of the Buddha or son or daughter of the Buddha, I don't know. Yeah, some people say that that's confusing. Some people just say bodhisattva. I do a meaning translation. Okay, so having the Tathagata lineage and being born into the Tathagata lineage are not the same thing. Okay? Having the Tathagata lineage means that you have the Buddha nature. Okay? So you have that ability to become a Buddha. And being born into the Tathagata lineage refers to attaining the first ground, where you are now certainly on the road to full awakening. Okay. So, you know, from the very beginning, we have the Tathagata lineage, we have the Buddha nature. Everybody has it, but it's not sure whether you're going to go into the hearer, solitary realizer, bodhisattva path. Yeah, we don't know that about any sentient beings. Okay, but when a bodhisattva is born into the Tathagata lineage, it means that they've gone beyond the hearers and solitary realizers. You know, in the sense that their wisdom realizing emptiness is supported by bodhicitta, and they can never lose that realization. Yeah, so they're never going to fall back to being a hearer or a solitary realizer, let alone a regular old human being, let alone somebody in the lower realms. Okay, so the bodhisattva who's born into the Tathagata lineage is definitely on the path to full awakening. And, you know, you always pass go and always pass to collect $200 at that time. Okay, you never get bounced. Okay, people getting that? Okay, so then in the verse it says, through the maturation of that ground, the perfection of generosity becomes supreme. Okay, so, you know, the practice of generosity is so much better now than when they were an ordinary bodhisattva. Why do you think it's so much better now?
Because of the understanding.
Yeah, because it's informed by the wisdom realizing emptiness now. Okay, so so that somebody, if somebody asked one of these first ground bodhisattvas to give away their arms, legs, fingers, eyes, or the like, they would be totally happy to do so without any suffering or sense of loss, and without creating any non-virtue. Yeah, so they just give it away, you know? You give away your hand like you're giving away a carrot. You know, I mean, that's how much your body means to you. You're totally unattached to your body. So somebody comes and asks for something, really, it's like giving a carrot. Yeah, I think for these bodhisattvas, probably easier than for me giving a carrot for them to give their arms and legs, you know? If I give a carrot, I want to, like, really check out that I'm not going to need that carrot anytime soon. Because if I am, then I don't know if I'm going to give it. Okay? So, so this kind of giving of the body is impossible for bodhisattvas on the small, medium or great levels of the path of accumulation, or on any of the four levels of the path of preparation. Okay, so while those lower level bodhisattvas happily and without hesitation will give away their wealth and possessions, they're not able to give away their body in the same way. Okay, because it is easier to give your wealth and possessions than it is your body, isn't it? Yeah, so they have no problems with wealth and possessions. And they say even on path of accumulation, for that bodhisattva, you know, that some beggar comes and says, please, I need something. And that bodhisattva's just so happy. It's like, wow, I get to give something. I get to create merit, you know. And, but for giving their body, they have a little bit of apprehension, because it's going to hurt. And then, what happens if I, you know, if I give my liver, if I give, you know, my whole body altogether, what's going to happen? I might have physical suffering and mental suffering. Okay? So knowing that they will eliminate great suffering by experiencing this comparatively small suffering, they put effort into practicing the generosity of the parts of their body. However, they don't feel the same joy while doing it that the first grounders do. Okay? So they give their body, but, you know, there's some hesitation there, maybe some fear or anxiety. Okay. Then, then they are able to make 100 worlds shake. So that's talking about, you know, we went through the 12 sets, and so on the first ground you do, you know, you're able to go to 100 Buddha fields and ripen 100 sentient beings' minds and so on and so forth, so all those 12. And they become the great lord of Jambuvipa. So Jambuvipa is our southern continent, so they can choose, if they want to take rebirth as a wheel-turning Marnak, which with control over one world, which is our world of Jambuvipa. Okay? Yeah. Okay, did I cover everything? Yes, I think so. Yeah, so that's the first ground. So sounds nice, doesn't it? Yeah?
Could you explain, please, what it means to control?
It means that you're in the leadership position of leading the beings in that world. Yeah. So right now we need to talk to our wheel-turning monarch. Yeah, because it's only men, needs to intervene on the southern continent of Jambuvipa, ASAP. You know, like, can you do a miracle before 11:30 tomorrow morning? Yeah? Do you believe the miracles?
For some time now.
Yeah, so... Well, let's hope this wheel-turning monarch, you know, can do something. Okay.
So if the stream enterer and the first ground bodhisattva give up the same three fetters, but the first ground bodhisattva can accomplish so much more.
Yes.
So all that is powered by their bodhicitta and merit?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, the reason the bodhisattvas have so meant the qualities of the bodhisattvas way, way, way exceed the qualities of the stream enterers. And that's because of their merit and their practice of bodhicitta, their practice of the six perfections. And, you know, also because the way they realize emptiness, they look at it from many different perspectives. It's the realization is the same. But they can, their mind is very flexible and can look at it from many different perspectives. Yeah. So when you hear about in the Pali tradition, everybody wants to become a stream enterer because then you're kind of safe, you know, once you attain stream entry. But stream enterers still sometimes can have the eight worldly concerns. Yeah. They can still have afflictions, you know, manifest in their mind and, you know, all sorts of stuff. So, you know, whereas bodhisattvas have this ability to manifest, you know, 100 bodies and ripen the minds of 100 people and, you know, 100 sentient beings and so on. Yeah.
Can you give an analogy to help explain this difference between the hearers and the bodhisattva, probably in layman terms?
An analogy? Maybe it's like a kid in kindergarten who went to just an average school, and or a kid in first grade who went to an average school, and a kid in first grade who had all sorts of extracurricular activities, so that they have more abilities to do things. Maybe something like that? Yeah?
Very good.
Huh? Yeah. I'm just guessing, you know. Okay. But the hearers and solitary realizers aren't born into the Tathagata's family. Yeah, because they don't have the bodhicitta. And so, you know, unless they change vehicles quickly, they're going to go all the way through to arhatship, stay in meditative equipoise for a few eons, and then have to start the bodhisattva path at the path of accumulation.
One of the benefits of becoming a bodhisattva is that you become a child of the lineage. So,
yeah, that's the meaning here.
But that's on the path of accumulation. So I'm just trying to match up all these different descriptions.
Yeah.
The 10 benefits of bodhicitta.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too, because they always say the benefits of generating bodhicitta. You become a child of the Buddha. But here, he's, I mean, it says in the verse itself, it's not just Kensa Rinpoche's thing. It says, where does it say? Since they have been born into the Tathagata family. Yeah. So, maybe there's two levels. You know, there's birth and then there's birth. You know, maybe one is like your crowning and the other one is your out. Yeah. Maybe something like that. Yeah, because I was thinking about that too. They say that about the, you know, first generating bodhicitta. Okay. But that first generation of bodhicitta can also degenerate. You can lose it. Whereas here, the meaning of birth into a child, Tathagata's family, is that you are definitely going on to full awakening. There's no way to backslide. So the definition of the term is different here.
Although you could say that about the middling level of the
pathway. Yeah. You know, they don't backslide there, but again, it's not... I mean, their bodhisattva, their bodhicitta compared to a first grounder bodhicitta, big difference. Yeah, quite a big difference. So, I don't know. See if you can look it up and find out.
Which path is this first ground on?
The path of seeing.
Is that the moment when in sutras they say that ones receive prediction about the enlightenment from Amitabha or any other Buddha?
Mm. And when's that? When's the prediction? I can't remember if that's path of accumulation or not. It might be sometime on path of accumulation. Do you know? Yeah, I'm not sure exactly when it is. So I'm thinking of, you know, at least the story in the Pali scriptures is the Buddha in a previous life generated bodhicitta and then later that day received the prediction. So, I don't know. Okay, wanna get online and look it up? Yeah. People ask me the questions and then think I'm going to go spend all my time online answering their questions. You have a question. Look it up and report back next week. Okay? Let me have a pen so I remember who needs to report back.
It's only 15 minutes of internet.
Okay. You can use the internet. Okay. So, Venerable Sepal, what are you going to look up?
The difference between the child of the lineage of the initial bodhisattva of the accumulation, and bodhisattva is born into the lineage
on PA and on Bhumi 1. Okay. And Venerable Tenzin, you're going to look up
what is the point when one wants to receive
the prediction?
The point on the path when you receive a prediction. Okay, good. I'm glad we're going to get some answers to these questions. Okay, then the second grounder, so that's verse 443 and 444. The second ground is called the stainless, because bodhisattva's tenfold activities, I'll explain it in a minute, of body, speech, and mind are stainless, and they naturally adhere to those ethical activities. Through maturation of that ground, the perfection of ethical conduct becomes supreme. They become glorious rulers with the seven treasures, wheel-turning monarchs, beneficent to beings. Through its maturation, they become monarchs that rule all four continents. We should invoke that monarch too. Okay, so now we have two monarchs. Yeah. And they gain expertise in turning beings away from unethical behavior. Okay, so they're called the stainless because the 10 paths of non-virtue, you know, the 10, you know what those are, okay, don't stain their body, speech, and mind. So they've completely abandoned those 10 paths of non-virtue. Yeah? Both when they're awake and when they're asleep. Okay? So in their dreams, they don't even, you know, dream about killing anybody or having sex or anything like that. You know, their mind is completely clear. Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah? And we have to be so vigilant when, you know, in keeping our precepts and safeguarding our ethical conduct. And for these bodhisattvas, it's become so habitual. And, you know, the gross afflictions are subdued. And so, you know, their body, speech, and mind become stainless. Yeah, and so they still need to put some effort into ethical conduct, but just a little bit. Okay, so that's probably talking about the Pratimoksha ethical conduct. You know, definitely the bodhisattva and tantric ethical restraints are more difficult to keep. Okay, so the first ground bodhisattvas are not able to practice ethical conduct in the totally wonderful way that the second grounders can. Yeah, because the second grounders, you know, even they're pure even in their dreams. Maybe first ground bodhisattva maybe once in a while messes up in their dreams. Which, by the way, if you have, you know, a non-virtuous dream, it's extremely important when you wake up that you have regret. Yeah? Don't just say, oh, it was a dream, it doesn't matter. You know? Or, oh, that was a dream. Actually, oh, that was kind of nice. I couldn't, I can't do it in reality, but boy, that dream was sure felt good. No. Yeah. If you do that, then you create non-virtue. So it's very important if you have a non-virtuous dream that when you wake up, you generate regret. Of course, it isn't a complete karma because you didn't actually do the action. But if you rejoice at that dream, you're creating some destructive karma.
I do vajrasana right away.
Yeah, very good. That's exactly what we should do. Wake up, do vajrasattva. Yeah? And if you're having some kind of weird dream, You know, wake your, if you can wake yourself up, then take refuge. Yeah. Okay. Then the ripening result of a second grounder's supreme practice of ethical conduct is that they're able to take birth as a glorious wheel-turning monarch who has control over four continents. So that, you know, in one world system where you have Mount Meru and you have the four continents. So that, you know, the first ground bodhisattva is just our world. This ground bodhisattva, all four of those worlds, okay? And those are the monarchs that have the precious wheel, precious jewel, precious queen, precious minister, precious elephant, present horse, precious horse, and then general. Yeah. Okay. And these are all symbolic of worldly power. Yeah. When we are offering them, you know, because they're used as offerings too, like if you do a long life puja for your teacher, or in, you know, in Lama Chöpa, we offer these seven. So there you're offering not only the representations of worldly power, but these also have some kind of dharma meaning as well. Okay, so you're kind of offering that dharma meaning, and that's creating the cause for you to attain that. Okay. And then these bodhisattvas have 1,000 sets of the 12 qualities in the time of subsequent attainment. Okay, so 100 to the second power. Now, there's an interesting discussion here about ripening result. Okay, and Kenzo Rinpoche talks about it here. He says, according to the Chitta Madrans and below, so that's referring to the Vaibhasikas and Satantrikas, a ripening result must be either a polluted non-virtue or a polluted virtue. Okay. However, the Madhyamikas also accept unpolluted ripening causes. Okay. So, for example, the Madhyamikas posit the signs and marks of a Buddha, the 32 signs, 80 marks of a Buddha, as the ripening results of the unpolluted, uninterrupted paths of the 10 grounds. Okay, so those uninterrupted paths are the causes for the 32 and the signs and 80 marks. Now, earlier in this text, Nagarjuna went through all the specific causes, yeah, for the 32, for the 80, he just, you know, kind of put it in one bundle, okay? But those are kind of like the cooperative conditions for the development of the specific causes, but the general condition for all of this. He said at that time it was a collection of merit in general, yeah? But here he's saying, basically, it's the unpolluted, uninterrupted paths of the 10 grounds. Both make sense, don't they? I mean, you have to, it probably means both, actually. Yeah. Because some of the high Arya bodhisattvas, I know on path of on the 10th ground, they have a similitude of the 32 signs and 80 marks. Okay, so, so Kenzo Rinpoche says this is the same as saying that they are the ripening results of the practice of the 10 perfections. Okay, and, so these unpolluted ripening results experienced by Arya Bodhisattvas are produced by the concordant causes, the unpolluted virtue that these Aryas created on the Bodhisattva path. Okay, so here's where you have the wisdom and method together. Unpolluted virtue. The virtue is the collection of merit. The unpolluted is the collection of wisdom. Okay? So, why the Madhyamakas would say that you can have the 32 and the 80 are the ripening results of the unpolluted, uninterrupted path. Now, it's interesting because I was just, of course, going through the chapter on karma, and the usual description of ripening result, it has a very interesting description, which is probably the description that matches the Chittamatras and below, okay? Because here, he really differentiated, saying that the Chittamatras and below is talking about polluted virtue and non-virtue, okay? So my guess is that there's four things that make something a ripening result. My guess is that this is going to come either from Treasury of Knowledge or Compendium of Knowledge. Yeah.
The karma.
Huh?
The karma.
Yeah, this is what I'm going to say now.
Okay,
so there's usually four factors that describe a ripening result. So first is the cause is virtue or non-virtue, never a neutral cause. Okay. Second is the result is connected with the continuum of a sentient being. Third is the result comes after the cause. And fourth is the result itself is neutral. It's not virtuous or non-virtuous. So the cause is virtuous or non-virtuous, but the result itself is neutral. So if we take this, in the usual mean, what's the ripening result of karma?
Rebirth.
Yeah, a particular rebirth. So, the aggregates, especially the physical, the body aggregate you get. So that rebirth is caused by virtuous or non-virtuous karma, never by neutral karma, because you're either born in a fortunate rebirth or an unfortunate rebirth. There's nothing in the middle. Yeah. Yeah. The result is connected with the continuum of a sentient being. So yes, the rebirth and the body you take, and your mental aggregates connected to the continuum of a sentient being. The result comes after the cause, that's obvious. And the result is neutral, neither virtuous nor non-virtuous. So the body you take in a rebirth, the body itself is neutral. Okay? The body is true dukkha, and it's afflictive, but the body is not virtuous and not or non-virtuous. But its cause, in the case of a good rebirth, was virtuous. In the case of an unfavorable rebirth, was non-virtuous. Okay, so that's the usual explanation of the ripening result. Then it looks like the Madhyamaka are talking about the ripening result also in terms of the Buddha's body. With the 32 signs and 80 marks on a Buddha's body. Okay, so there the cause is virtuous, but a special kind of virtuous, unpolluted virtue. So it has to be virtue created by an Arya. Yeah, the result is connected with the continuum of a sentient being. Well, if you have the facsimile of the 32 and 80, it's with the continuum of a sentient being. But if it's with the Buddha's 32 and 80, that's not the continuum of a sentient being. The Buddha isn't a sentient being.
But it was, right up till then.
Yeah, but we're talking about the Buddha's 32 and 80.
Yeah.
They aren't the same as the 10th ground bodhisattvas. The 10th ground bodhisattva is still a sentient being. The Buddha is not. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's going to be something different. The result comes after the cause. And the result is neutral. It's neither virtuous nor non-virtuous. That one I want to check on. Because I remember there's a verse, describing the the virtues of the Buddha's body. Yeah? There's one verse. Where is it? Maybe in Giorgio somewhere? Yeah? And there's a verse. So I want to ask about that. You know? It's the 32 and 80 for the continuum of a Buddha. If they're neutral, I think I have a suspicion that they would be virtuous. Yeah?
It's weird sounding to say they're neutral.
Huh?
It just sounds weird that it would be neutral.
Yeah, that something about the Buddha would be neutral. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay, but anyway, that was a little diversion to talk about ripening result and see, you know, talking about it in terms of sentient beings and then the Madhyamaka way of talking about it in terms of Aryas. Okay. Then having, now this is real interesting. Because they have such perfect ethical conduct, they have a very peaceful radiance, okay? So this is a physical characteristic that they have, yeah? And, and in general they say that people with very pure ethical conduct do have a certain glow or radiance about them. Usually they say somebody with pure ethical conduct has a very sweet smell. That, you know, and so incense is like a cause for perfecting your ethical conduct, at least if you offer nice smelling incense, not some of the stinky kinds. That they have a sweet smell from ethical conduct. But here it's saying that they actually have a glow to them. So, okay.
I think Geshe Sopa, he had such a glow. And even closer to his death, he was like radiating.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, somebody like Geshe Sopa, definitely. You know. Here's maybe where we can talk about the vibe. You know? Somebody has good vibes. Yeah, Geshe Sopa for sure. Yeah, for sure had that.
Thinking of this ground in terms of what is abandoned, would that be non-virtue that is abandoned on this ground?
Yeah, well, what they've completely abandoned is the level of afflictions and afflictive obscurations that are to be abandoned on the second ground. So on the second ground, they're starting to abandon some of the afflictions from the root. Yeah. So they've abandoned all the non-virtuous actions already. Yeah. Is that your question?
Yeah, I'm just thinking what specifically they're working on that ground, on the second ground, abandoning.
The portion of afflictions that are to be abandoned by the second ground. Each ground, yeah, has a certain portion of the afflictions that it abandons. You know, if you remember that there are 81 levels of afflictions, and then they combine them, and so each level has, each bodhisattva level actually has some of those that they're abandoning. Yeah, and so it's just different degrees. Yeah, it's all the afflictions, but certain degrees. It's not like you abandon attachment on one ground and anger on another ground. No, you abandon a similar degree of attachment and anger on one ground and a similar degree of attachment and anger on another ground. But it's a deeper level. Yeah, okay. Okay, then the third ground. Okay, the third ground is called the luminous. Okay, first was the joyous, second the stainless, third the luminous. Because the light of peaceful wisdom arises, the concentrations and super knowledges have arisen, and attachment and anger have completely ceased. This needs some interpretation, some explanation. Through the maturation of that ground, they practice supreme fortitude and joyous effort, and they become the celestial's skilled great lord who averts all sensual desire. Okay, so the third ground is called the luminous, because what these bodhisattvas are meditating one pointedly on emptiness. There's a sign that appears that is like a light, and it's called the light indicating the end of all obstacles is approaching. So it is signaling the impending end of the cognitive obscurations. Now, why this comes on the third ground, when the cognitive obscurations are not eliminated until the end of the tenth ground, you have to ask somebody else to explain why, because I have that same question too. Yeah. Sometimes on these ground where it says you're approaching something, then you wonder, well, why on that ground and not on another ground? Because here they haven't even finished eliminating the afflictive obscurations, and yet it says they're approaching ending the cognitive obscurations, but they have at least one more countless great eon in the three pure grounds, plus, you know, a good chunk of time, you know, spent on the path of meditation too. So
the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, maybe that's it, yeah. Yeah, it's the light at the end of the tunnel. So it still is a ways away, but you can see it.
Yeah.
There, that's good. Yes, that's it. The light at the end of the tunnel. Okay, so they must attain only a few more grounds before Buddhahood. Yeah, it takes a long time, but yeah, you can see the end of the tunnel. Now, this is interesting. The light does not appear to the mind of meditative equipoise. Why not? Because only emptiness appears to that mind. Okay, so the mind that light doesn't appear to that mind. That mind doesn't see that light. It doesn't attend to that light. Okay, because that light is a conventional phenomena, and there's no appearance of conventional phenomena. Okay, however. Yeah, while these bodhisattvas sit in meditation, there's the appearance of a light shining on them, as if they were sitting in the sun and the sunlight is striking them. So that's kind of like this afternoon I took a walk, and at the top of one of the trees here, the sunlight was striking it, just one section of the tree, and that tree, which is normally green, was all of a sudden like the color of our robes. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Or if maybe you looked across the valley and you saw right before the sun went down, it was striking the mountaintops there. Yeah? So that kind of light, so that bodhisattva is sitting in meditation, and you know, they're probably not sitting in the sun, yeah, but there's a light on them that looks like they're sitting in the sunlight, okay? And so that's the sign that the end of all the obstacles is approaching.
Like a halo?
Huh? Yeah, maybe something like that.
Sure.
Yeah, your first halo. Yeah, oh, you took a picture of it.
No, it's last year.
It was last year. I'll put it on the website anyway. Because it happened again today. Yeah, exactly like that. Yeah. Okay, so when these bodhisattvas arise from meditation, a light resembling the red light at dawn appears to their wisdom of subsequent attainment. So it doesn't appear to the wisdom of meditative equipoise. You know, the external sign appears to others at that time, but it appears to those bodhisattvas to their wisdom of subsequent attainment. Okay. So Kenzo Rinpoche says, it's like an electric light that has a white radiance that exudes, but it does not appear to it. Yeah. In the same way, a light comes from that wisdom of meditative equipoise, but does not appear to it and is not realized by it. But it happens as a result of being in that deep state of meditation, having eliminated that particular bit of the afflictions. Okay, then the third ground bodhisattvas have attained the four concentrations of the material realm. So those are the four jhanas, or four dhyanas, which their names are first, second, third, and fourth. Okay? They've attained the four immaterial absorptions. Yeah, so the immaterial absorptions on infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, and then neither discrimination nor non-discrimination, also called the peak of samsara. Okay, so they've attained those. So here you can see, you know, this bodhisattva is, it's interesting because it says that they've eliminated attachment and anger, but what it means is the attachment and anger of that particular, bit. There, kind of like the once returners, they've eliminated a good chunk of attachment and anger, but not all of it. Okay, so a little bit like that. But these bodhisattvas, you know, they've actualized all the levels of concentration all the way up the scale. Yeah, to become an arhat, you don't need to do that. Yeah, you only need to realize emptiness. Yeah, and use that to cleanse your mind. So here already you can see again some of the special abilities that bodhisattvas have that others don't have. Okay. They've also attained the five super knowledges. So do you remember those? Let's start at the beginning. What's the first one? Huh? Supernormal powers with your body, making one body appear as many, turning it back into one, walking on water, going under the earth, flying in the sky, all these kinds of things. So that's the first one.
And the divine ear.
Yeah, second one's the divine ear, so you can hear things that are far away. So you need a really virtuous mind if you're going to listen to everybody else's gossip, you know, because if you don't have a virtuous mind, you're going to get really upset listening to their gossip, or you'll get really bored. So we should be careful when we gossip, because there may be some bodhisattvas with a divine ear listening in. Yeah?
That's why it's done on the third part, right? That's why it's realized on the third part, which is
fortitude, yeah, right. Okay, then the third one is the ability to know others' minds. Okay.
What is the difference between the mind and hearing what you think?
The second one is the divine ear, so you can hear things that are far away. Yeah, first one is the...
but hearing and... knowing what is in the mind, what is the difference?
Oh, because one is you're hearing the sounds. The knowing the mind is they're not speaking. You read their mind.
By all sorts of pictures, too, images. You know, whatever's going on in the mind of sentient beings, you would be able to see.
They know what you're thinking about.
You need fortitude
for that.
Huh?
You need fortitude for that.
Yes.
That's why a lot of Tibetans are so, you know, afraid of being in front of lamas.
Yeah. One reason why you try and watch what you're saying. Of course, who knows what's going on in your mind. Then the fourth one is the recollection of previous lives. So you know your own previous lives. The fifth one is knowing the death and rebirth of other living beings. Yeah, so those are the five ones. There's also a sixth one that they don't have here, but what is the sixth one?
Is it the only the one the Buddha has?
Or an arhat?
Knowing
the cessation of afflictions, yeah. The destruction of pollutants. Okay, but these bodhisattvas don't have that one. They have the first five. Okay. The last three are also called the three higher knowledges. If you remember the story of the Buddha's life, these are the three that he realized the night before he attained awakening. So they've realized the five super knowledges, the four immeasurables, those you should be able to recite.
Immeasurable love, immeasurable compassion, immeasurable equanimity, immeasurable joy.
Yeah, so the orders, there's two orders. One order is love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Another order is equanimity, love, compassion, joy. Okay, so those... are also objects when you're developing concentration. So these third ground bodhisattvas have, you know, very strong concentration too. You can see it's really improving above what the second ground was. Okay. When Nagarjuna says that attachment and anger have been completely ceased, it doesn't mean that they've been completely ceased. It means that the degrees of these afflictions that are to be eliminated on the third ground have been ceased. There are further degrees that are to be eliminated later on. Okay. Then, okay. So some forms of attachment and anger arise due to grasping the person as self-sufficient, substantially existent, and some arise due to grasping, you know, at inherent existence. Okay, on the first seven grounds, yeah, the different portions of the innate grasping at self-sufficient, substantially existent are ceased. The acquired form of that grasping and all the afflictions, when, put it this way, when the acquired grasping as self-sufficient, substantially existent was eliminated on the, what path? Path of seeing, first bhumi, yeah. Then all the afflictions associated with, all the acquired afflictions were all associated with grasping self-sufficient, substantial existence were also eliminated. When you eliminate the grasping at self-sufficient, substantial existence, that's to be eliminated on the second ground. All the afflictions that are associated, that arise due to that particular level of grasping at self-sufficient, substantial existence, are eliminated. And that's already innate grasping. On the third ground, you eliminate a deeper level of self-sufficient, substantial existence and the afflictions that arise out of that. And so on up to the end of the seventh ground. But at the end of the seventh ground, when you start the eighth ground, then all of the afflictive obscurations have been completely eliminated. Okay? So the self-grasping at self-sufficient, substantial existent person has an acquired form and an innate form. Then similarly, grasping at the inherent existence of a person and the afflictions that arise from that, which are subtler afflictions. Yeah, all so the innate grasping, I mean, the acquired grasping of truly existent person and the afflictions arising out of that, or actually just true existence, we can say. We don't have to specify person or phenomena. And the afflictions arising out of that, that the acquired forms, eliminated path of seeing, first ground, then the innate forms of grasping at true existence and the afflictions that arise due to that portion of grasping at true existence are eliminated on the second ground, and so on up. Again, till the end of the seventh bhumi, and then all the grasping at true existence has been eliminated.
So then, this is where they say that in this, is this the Madhyamaka that says that both the acquired and the afflictive are simultaneous? Wasn't there?
No. We're talking Prasangika.
Prasangika.
Yeah. So the acquired afflictions are eliminated first.
Self-sufficient, substantial existence.
Self-sufficient, substantial. Don't confuse. There's acquired
and
innate.
Right.
And then there's grasping self-sufficient, substantial existent, and grasping true existence.
Right.
Okay. The latter is grosser than the former.
Right.
Both of those two kinds of graspings have both of the two levels of afflictions.
Ah.
They both have acquired and innate forms.
Okay. And they start on the path of seeing.
Yes. Yeah, both of the acquired forms plus the acquired afflictions associated with them are ceased on the path of seeing, which is the first ground.
Okay.
Then with each level of the bodhisattva path, yeah, the innate grasping at self-sufficient, substantial existent, and the innate afflictions associated with that ground that are to be abandoned, and the innate grasping at true existence, and the innate afflictions associated with that particular ground, let's say the second ground, then those are eliminated by the uninterrupted and liberated path of the second ground.
Okay.
Then on the third ground, you have the same thing. But here it's a subtler level of the innate grasping. But at both the self-sufficient, substantial existent person and the truly existent person.
So we're going on at the same time.
Yes.
You don't eliminate that.
Yeah. Because even though it's a coarser grasping, because, you know, one is acquired and one is innate. Acquired is easier to get rid of than innate, because acquired you learned from a false philosophy. Innate has been with you since beginningless time. So even though grasping at self-sufficient, substantial existence person isn't as coarse as grasping at true existence.
It's not as subtle.
Not as subtle.
Then still it's innate, and so the innate ones have to be eliminated on the higher ground.
Yes. But not before grasping it inherent existence.
Yeah.
Simultaneous.
Right.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
But wasn't there a part of what we were studying the schools is that some of the schools believe that the acquired get done all together first, and then you steal the innate.
And then, no. There's a difference in the schools. Some, the Madhyamaka, Prasangika for sure, says first you eliminate all the afflictive obscurations, then on the pure grounds you eliminate the cognitive obscurations. And I think it's the Yogacharya Svatantrika. They believe that there's some overlap where you're eliminating both the afflictive and different levels of cognitive at the same time. I can't remember where they're overlapping.
Yogi Bilwe Patani say that
say that you eliminate the clipped up to ground 8, mm-hmm. and then you and you're eliminating the cognitive at that same time, and you continue eliminating the cognitive. So if the cognitive are eliminated on all 10 grounds, the afflictive obscurations are eliminated.
About the first seven. And that's
the
Sautantrika, Svatantrika.
Okay.
What about the Yogacharya Svatantrika?
They eliminate both obscurations all the way on all 10 grounds.
On all 10 grounds. Okay. So different assertions about when you eliminate different stuff. Try it out and see for yourself which one works. Okay. Okay. So the third ground bodhisattvas excel in the practice of the perfection of fortitude. Yeah. So you know, they don't mind if people rip off their possessions. They don't get upset if somebody cuts up their body. So if somebody whose name we know institutes torture again, then these bodhisattvas would not experience pain from that. But sentient beings would experience extreme pain. So let's not do that. So these bodhisattvas, you know, because they have very strong fortitude, they actually have very strong empathy and compassion for whoever it is who is cutting up their body. Yeah? So if you had a bodhisattva that for whatever reason was working as a spy, was captured by the CIA, and under the old rules, and perhaps reinstituting those new rules, yeah, that bodhisattva would not experience pain from that kind of, from waterboarding, for example. Pretty amazing, huh? And that bodhisattva would have incredible empathy and compassion for the person who was torturing them, as well as the whole chain of command ending with the top person who authorized that. That person would have compassion and see all of them as suffering sentient beings who are only creating the cause for incredible suffering themselves.
It must be, what a feeling to feel that. You know, to be able to be in front of the person that are harming you and just looking in his eyes and feel for them. They really feel for them. Yeah, they're just confused and in pain, and there's no anger or whatever arising in you except, may you be free.
Yeah.
May you be free also.
And this is our practice for the next 4 years.
May he be free also.
Yeah. Huh? May he be free as well. And all of his seance. Yeah. I mean, that's got to be our practice, doesn't it? You know, there's no choice.
And to think that this is all the cause of happiness.
To think what?
That what's happening is going to bring happiness to himself and to the country.
Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty big level of confusion, isn't it? Yeah.
It's bringing the country together, I think.
It's bringing a certain portion of the country together.
It will resonate.
Yeah.
It will.
Yeah.
Venerable, does the person who authorizes or reinstitutes or approves torture then gathers up all the negative karma for all the tortures done under that?
Yep, even if they don't do the torture themselves, because they have the power and they said yes, do it, then they accumulate the karma of doing it, even though they didn't do it themselves. So it's pretty heavy karma. Yeah? It's pretty heavy karma. And, you know, here's where we see so truly, you know, what is said so often in the sutras, that sentient beings want happiness, but they're continually creating the cause for suffering. Yeah, this is what it means. I mean, here we're seeing it right in front of our eyes. So let's hope that doesn't happen. Yeah. But if it does, we have to see it through the eyes of karma and compassion. We'll finish the third Bhumi next time. Okay. Oh, there's a question. Yes, okay.
Do the bodhisattvas possess the three bodies of a Buddha, the Dharmakaya, Nyanamkaya, and Sambhogakaya?
No. Those are the three bodies of the Buddha, not of bodhisattvas.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losam's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of explaining
and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West, for